More women and kids are homeless here in Northeast Florida. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. And just ahead on the show, new data on this city's homeless population, especially the growth in youth homelessness and what to do about it. You can get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later in our Going Green, why living shorelines could be the solution for people who live along the coastline here in Florida as seas rise and storms get worse. We'll tell you about that. All of that and more ahead this morning, but first this hour, it's a brand new snapshot looking at the homeless population in our area, especially in the downtown urban core and at the beaches. In particular, the new numbers show a big spike in youth homelessness, more kids on the streets. Now, this report was just presented to the Jacksonville City Council, and it also has some important recommendations. Dawn Gilman is CEO of Changing Homelessness. Dawn, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa, and thank you for having me on during Hunger and Homeless Awareness Week.
That's right. It's Hunger and Homeless Awareness Week. So what are your questions and comments about this? Give us a call right now as we discuss the new report out from Changing Homelessness, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org or tweets to at Melissa in Jax. Okay, so Changing Homelessness collects this important data every year, and you're out with a whole new set of numbers. How did you do this, first of all? How did you collect this information?
Great question. In August, for the past 2 years, we've had about 100 volunteers go out to what we call known places. We do an annual point-in-time count in January that's both for sheltered and unsheltered people. And then we again go out in August specifically looking for people who are living on the streets. They're unsheltered, just to see if there's changes or trends we need to be especially aware of, and to see if the trends we saw in January are holding through the rest of the year.
And you found something worrisome. It's always worrisome, of course, to have this many people homeless, but something new in the numbers?
Yes. And let me just clarify. When we talk about youth, it's young people ages 18 to 24. We saw a pretty surprising uptick in our point-in-time count from January 2017 to 2018, about a 65% increase. When we did the surge, we saw over 100% increase. And these are young people who are literally homeless, meaning they're living on the streets or in their cars, in the parks, highway overpasses. It appears we're going to do a little bit more of a deep dive on this. These are young people that are not going in or accessing any services that might be available to them. Part of that could be because there are very few services dedicated to that age group. It could also just be these are kids that don't know where to go. This mm-hmm. is probably their first time homeless, and they may not understand that there is help and assistance out there for them.
What are your questions and thoughts about what to do to reduce the numbers of homeless in this area? As we speak with Dawn Gilman of Changing Homelessness, give us a call, 549-2937. Okay, so you have made a lot of progress, Dawn, over the years with the chronic homeless population and the veteran homeless population. Those numbers have gone down, which is good news. But the big issue now that it sounds like you're dealing with is unaccompanied youth and families with children, too, particularly women and kids who are homeless.
Women and kids. And I'd also add into that group that kind of nebulous all other. These are single adults over 25. And again, there's very few resources for them. When I talk to city council people or just the general population, these are the people you're most likely to see and notice. Families with children, especially single head of household families, are going to be much more hidden. They're going to be protecting their kids. When you walk downtown or at the beaches, or when you notice people as you're driving through the city, a lot of the people that you're seeing are these other groups.
Now, you presented all of this to the Jacksonville City Council last night and took a lot of questions from them. And you also talked about the seven elements of what you'd like to see in terms of a system of care so that we don't have any homeless people in Jacksonville.
Absolutely. And I want to be really clear with all of our 40 plus partner agencies. We have a system of care in place, but like all social services systems, there are unmet needs and weak points. probably one of our biggest one is that the first thing we talk about, which is diversion. This would be flexible funding to divert people completely away from the system. In other communities, this has been especially effective with those families with children, being able to safely divert 30 to 50% of those households from any kind of emergency shelter or other services.
Okay, let's go to some calls now for Dawn Gilman of Changing Homelessness. Just under 2,000 people are showing up in their count of the homeless population in our area. That is an overall decrease.
Correct.
Which is good news. The bad news is there are a lot more young adults out on the streets and women with children. What are your thoughts, comments, questions? 549-2937. Mitchell is in Palatka. Hi, Mitchell. Good morning.
Good morning. I've spoke to you before, but I live in a converted semi-truck trailer on 3 acres of rural land, but I live by myself. I think the solution to the homeless problem is not so much for the cities to say, we've got to do it, but for many people that are homeless to do things for themselves. This business of living in a car is not a bad idea. If you learn how to do it right, you can survive pretty well living in particularly a van. And I've lived in a tent for a year in the freezing cold in Atlanta. The solution is to help people that are homeless to do things for themselves that they will enjoy doing and will be satisfied with, rather than saying, oh, the city has to do everything.
Okay. Well, Mitchell, let me ask you a little bit more about your situation. How long have you been where you are? And are you, tell me a little bit more about how you got to where you are right now.
Well, I'm 74 and I ran for mayor of Atlanta, and, a governor of Georgia on previous occasions.
Okay.
I live with my 25 goats here on my 3 acres. But 25 goats could never survive on 3 acres, and I've got 1,000 acres of unused land to take them out and feed them on.
So why do you have so many goats?
Well, goats are nice to have around. They're very pleasant, and they have the big advantage over dogs and cats that they can feed themselves in many ways. And they're something you can, in an emergency, you can eat them yourself.
Oh, man, Mitchell, you're freaking me out a little bit. But I appreciate you calling and giving me your thoughts. And I'm getting a really vivid image right now of you with all the goats down there in Palatka. And I like hearing all about it. So I appreciate the call. Okay, that's Mitchell in Palatka. Dawn.
So the one advantage that Mitchell has is that he owns that land. He's legally able to stay there. The people that we're interviewing, especially that are living in their cars or in highway overpasses or in tents, do not have a legal right to be where they are. If JSO is called, they can be trespassed off the property or arrested. So Mitchell is right there. It isn't just a city problem. There is also a very hidden problem, or more hidden problem, in our rural areas. And there are lots of different solutions that are needed to fully address this issue.
Like what?
One that comes up all the time are tiny homes. So tiny homes are small dwellings. I have 3 questions that I always ask anyone that brings up tiny homes. The first one is, number one, can you legally put it where you want to? This includes zoning issues, size issues, being able to have multiple homes on one thing. Number two, which surprises some people, are you going to hook them up to electricity and sewer and water? To make it a home versus a shed, people have to have access to be able to bathrooms and cooking. And number three, what's your plan to maintain the dwellings? If it's a community, is this going to be a resident-run community where they will make up their rules? Is this going to be owned by a nonprofit or another entity, more like a condo association where there's rules imposed on the whole? So that's one area. Those tiny homes can be good for single adults.
They're building some for local veterans right now.
They are. And this has been popular in different parts of the country. But even with the veteran population here in Northeast Florida, we have a large number of veterans who have families. And while I live in a smaller home with my family, I'm not sure we could fit into what is officially a tiny home of under 300 square
that
feet.
That might be difficult.
Yes.
Yeah. They're primarily for a single individual.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Catherine on the south side. Hi, Catherine. Good morning.
Hey, Melissa. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I have pretty much the opposite of Mitchell to tell you about, but I've got a couple of questions and a couple of comments. I would like to know of those, that 18 to 23-year-old group, 25-year-old group, how many of those kids, now young adults, were in the foster care system? Because I bet it's a very large number. And secondly, I think it's important to show that a lot of those kids didn't bring it on themselves. It's not like they have drug problems or criminal records. So I'm working with a 22, about to be 23-year-old right now, trying to get him in a home. He has a young baby that he is trying to take care of. And for him to be, first of all the homeless shelters were full. For him to get assistance, except the only homeless shelter that was open was the at Salzbach, where he could sleep on the floor with 30 other guys, but no baby could go there. But then to get assistance, he had to go prove he was homeless for so many days. And I'm like, how do you prove you're homeless?
Yeah.
And the problem with getting these kids, so here he is, he has no drug record. He is a previous foster kid. But he has no drug record, no drug problem, no criminal record. But he's got to come up with, you know, enough to pay first and last month rent or a deposit and electricity and everything else to get it in his name. And he right now what he's doing is he works a day job and he has to pay for a hotel for him to sleep in. Each night he uses all the money he makes during the day to pay for food and a roof over his head.
Exactly.
How can he ever get ahead?
It's so difficult.
He can't get ahead.
Yeah. So what can he do is the question. That's Catherine on the line from the South Side. I believe that's an old friend of mine, Catherine McAvoy, who runs the city's Performance Academy. She's such a great person. Catherine, thank you for the call. So what can her friend, this young man she's trying to help, this is a typical story.
This is a very typical story, what Catherine is talking about. This young man is doing all the right things, but there is not enough assistance in the system for everyone. One of the things that we have done to be able to drive those numbers down is triage. Through coordinated intake that is managed by our partner at MHRC, they assess everybody who is homeless. For Catherine's friend, they can do a self-declaration that they are homeless. We do try to get some sort of proof. The reason for that is a lot of the funding that we get is federal or governmental funding. And when we're monitored and audited, we ask for it.
So should she and her young associate call you?
She can call us. I would continue to work with the Sulzbacher Center to see if he would be eligible for one of the apartments there, or go to MHRC to see if there is any kind of opening at some other affordable apartments throughout the city.
And MHRC is?
Mental Health Resource Center.
Okay.
At their downtown campus. But I feel her frustration, and this is what we work with on a daily basis. When I say triaging the most vulnerable, that's a euphemism for the person that is most likely to die gets assistance first. Very often these are older individuals that are diagnosed or duly diagnosed with different physical or mental health issues. I also think a really important point that she made is this young man does not have a drug or alcohol problem. He does not have a mental health issue that is inhibiting him from this, but he did not have the same start in life and the family support that most of us would have if we would have found ourselves in this situation at 23 with a baby to take care of. So I do not have an easy road out for him, other than if this is your friend, I'm sure you can get her in touch with me. I will see through the coordinated entry system what other resources are out there and available.
Yeah. Catherine, let's you and I connect later today on that. And let's go now. Lots of calls meanwhile for Don Gilman, CEO of Changing Homelessness, as we talk about their new snapshot, looking at the percentage of people in this area who are homeless. The big number that jumps out is the spike in youth homelessness, young adults. Emmett is near the beach. Hey, Emmett, good morning.
Good morning. This idea is an idea that came from a group in Austin, Texas called Homefront. And what they do is they take a veteran and they put him in a house for 2 years, and the person pays into escrow. At the end of 2 years, if the person is able to handle the house with his family, they give him the escrow money back, and the house is his free and clear forever. Our idea is to put a vet in a house, a sponsored house, build it or put him into one. He pays for 5 years. At the end of 5 years, the house is his free and clear. Now, it takes a sponsor to sponsor the house to get the vet started. But the money that they pay into this is into a pay it forward pool of money, which can be only used to build more houses. There are people doing things like this. There's a group in Brunswick I talked to, they're doing it. There's a group in Tampa that did it. But the Austin, Texas people, the Homefront group, they're big, they're financially sound people, have a lead. The point is that the pay it forward pool, anyone who put money into it would be tax deductible. Plus it would morph. It wouldn't have to just be veterans. So it would be a way of gaining money, and the person who gained the home would be a capitalist. He'd own it. And it's a new idea, and it isn't really flying yet, but it's out there.
Yeah. Thanks, Emmett. Thanks for that.
So Emmett, that is a great idea. And there's different small experiments going on like that. And I especially like that you are willing to expand this beyond veterans. Veterans has been one of our great examples in Northeast Florida. We have driven the rate of veteran homelessness down to a tremendous amount. We actually have a by name list that is updated weekly. And right now we're under 75 homeless veterans that we have been able to identify and contact that are in our community. But an idea like that, especially if it was a smaller affordable home for our rising number of families who are homeless or those young people who are homeless would be great. Another interesting idea that people are doing around the country, especially for youth and parenting youth also, are host homes. So that is where someone for a small amount of time, maybe a couple months, maybe longer, will actually allow that young person to live in their home with a set rules and agreements of what the family rules are. But it gives them that stability to be able to launch themselves.
Michelle in St. John's. Hey, Michelle, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I'm a professor at UNF, and I've seen an uptake in the homeless student population at UNF. And I would like to encourage your listeners, UNF has a pantry called the Lend-A-Wing Pantry, and for students who are homeless or financially disadvantaged, they can come in and essentially take 5 pounds of whatever goods they need. So if you're interested in doing something proactive, I encourage your listeners to Google UNF Lend-A-Wing Pantry and bring in shelf-stable goods, paper goods, toilet paper, feminine products, also gently used professional wear for those students.
And it's called what again, Michelle?
The UNF Lend-A-Wing Pantry.
Oh, you mean like for the Osprey, is that what that's about? Lend-A-Wing? Okay. The UNF Lend-A-Wing Pantry. Yes, people need to Google that and drop off some donated goods because there are homeless students on the UNF campus. And Michelle is saying there's a spike in those. Thanks, Michelle, for that.
So Michelle is correct. There is a spike in homeless kids on all of our local college campuses, Edward Waters.
What's driving all this?
Economics. Right now, there are a group of kids who have just been making it with their families. Sometimes they get to college. They do not fully understand all the expenses they might be incurring. It could be for economic reasons. Their families are no longer to help be able to help them out as they once were. It can also be a pride thing. These are for our young people, 18 to 24. There are a lot of in Florida, legally, after the 18th birthday, you do not have to continue to support your children because they are now adults. So sometimes family dynamics are causing this issue. It is for every person who is experiencing homeless. There's a story behind it.
We have a lot of stories waiting on hold,
yes,
actually.
Yes, we do.
Becky is at the beaches. Hi, Becky. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa. Now, I don't know anything about mental illness or being homeless and having a child, but I was a young person at one time, and I decided when I was 18 that I no longer wanted to adhere to the rules of my mother's household, and I moved out, and I had a part-time jobs at the Pig Barbecue and Jack in the Box and various places waiting tables, and I networked with friends, and we got little apartments. Now, did we move maybe every 3 or 4 or 6 months? Sure, it was a tumultuous time, but it was sort of fun and adventurous, and you're very resilient at that age. So maybe these young people don't realize that maybe through networking with their friends, they can get a little apartment together. Maybe, you know, it's not always pleasant to live with other people, but that's what you do when you're a young person. I never had a place all to myself, really, until I was married in my early 30s. So to think that a young person can have a place to themselves, I think, is unrealistic. I think we need to teach them how to network and find little jobs here and there and get apartments with roommates.
Thanks, Becky.
So, Becky, I think the important thing for you to know is the apartment and rental market has changed dramatically in the last several years. When I first started almost 10 years ago, we could almost always find some place to rent for under $500. We could maybe even negotiate with a smaller place to have utilities included and do a lot of really creative things. So someone that is working a part-time minimum wage job with roommates could afford a place. If you look at the city of Jacksonville, they have recently put out their consolidated plan, which includes the increases in rental prices and first-time homes, and they have gone up almost 50%.
So even with roommates, what you're saying is an affordable apartment is out of reach for many teenagers, young adults.
Yes, because they are less desirable renters. They don't have a rental history. So landlords at that price point can now afford to be incredibly choosy. The lower you go on the rental price point, the higher the occupancy rate is. So if you're going below what is considered fair market value for the county, you are at 95%+ occupancy.
Lots of calls waiting on hold. We can't get to all of them, although we're getting questions about mental health and the connection with mental health issues and homelessness. That's part of this population, not all of it.
Correct. But you are, I will say that the people that we all notice the most when we are walking around or in our daily lives who are homeless are probably mentally ill. And that, because that's who we notice, that becomes our perception
That's the image we have, but it's not the full picture. And,
correct.
And if Catherine is still listening, people want to let you know about the Family Promise Program to help your young man. We're also getting tweets that Jasmine of Jacksonville provides help with accessing homeless services for young people under the age of 24. And a tweet from Chad, where can we get a copy of this new report?
It will be on our website at www.changinghomelessness.org. And I do not know if it is up yet. It will be up by tomorrow, which is our, we're doing an open house and doing an official unveiling and a thank you to all of our volunteers that helped us get the data to put the report together.
And we'll have more of this on our website as well later today. Don Gilman, CEO of Changing Homelessness. Thank you.
Thank you.
And later in the hour, the Jacksonville dad changing the conversation about which parent is most likely to diaper their baby. But up next, the growth of living shorelines here in Florida. That's in our Going Green. We'll be right back.
Jessica Palumbo. Every Thursday, I host The Jackson on WJCT.
We actually have some pretty great public spaces here in Jacksonville.
Jacksonville is still trying to wrap its head around clustering.
The urban core was Jacksonville's original city limits before consolidation in 1968.
Tomorrow during Morning Edition, here on 89.9.
Support for The Jackson on WJCT comes from the Jacksonville Police and Fire Pension Fund.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Welcome back. Well, centuries of dredging and development have replaced wetlands throughout the U.S. with thousands of miles of rocks and concrete. In fact, for every 7 miles of coastline in our lower 48 states, it's estimated that about 1 mile is hardened with a seawall or a bulkhead to protect the land and property. You see a lot of that here in our area. But here's the thing. Rising costs from flooding and erosion are prompting many homeowners, along with military installations, to go for a more natural alternative. It's what's known as a living shoreline, and it can improve water quality, it can support fisheries, and it will also protect against storms and rising sea levels. We learned about this yesterday, both producer Lindsay Kilbride and myself, as we went out on a boat trip in the Intercoastal Waterway with the folks at the GTM Reserve. That's the Guanatolomato-Matanzas National Estuarine Research Reserve. And that's a mouthful. Take a listen.
So, Mike, what are we going to see here today?
Well, today we're going to actually visit two study sites. Both are pretty much helping us understand and address the issue of sea level rise. So this project is looking at changes in carbon storage, right, of the marshes.
They're looking at any below ground changes as temperatures rise and you shift from a salt marsh to mangrove ecosystem.
So again, it's one of those studies that's linked to climate change and understanding those subtle differences that happen in the soils.
Joining us now in our Going Green to tell us more about this, we welcome Mike Shirley, director of the GTM, NERR, Good morning. Good to see you.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me on.
Also in studio, John Upton, features journalist at Climate Central. Hey, John.
Hey, Melissa. Great to be here.
And on the phone, Christine Angelini. She's assistant professor in environmental engineering sciences at the University of Florida. Hey, Christine.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me on.
Good to have you. In a moment, we'll hear about Christine's study, which is going on right there now out at the reserve. But first, Mike Shirley, let's begin with you and talk about the GTM Research Reserve and what a treasure it is. Ecologically, there's so much happening out there. Give us a quick snapshot.
Okay. A reserve is essentially designated to be a research platform. We use it for education and research. We're part of a national system. In Florida, we're also part of the Department of Environmental Protection. So many of the staff there work for both DEP and UNF. And so what we love to do is explore possibilities in terms of research and getting scientists and educators out to basically explore the reserve and learn what it has to teach.
And one thing that we learned a little bit about yesterday on the boat, and that, John, you are actually writing about for Climate Central, is the growth of living shorelines and how those can be a more effective way to protect the shore, protect homeowners' property, even protect a government or military installation. This is something that's fascinating to see, and it's becoming more and more important, particularly with stronger storms battering Florida, rising sea levels. Why is this important for us to learn about?
Well, what we're seeing is a real sudden, and it's just the very start, but a real shift away from hard seawalls and in the direction of living shorelines, which are much more cost-effective and provide a lot of coastal benefits, both for people and also for wildlife.
We're talking about seedlings, oyster shell, bags of oyster shells, more natural alternatives.
Sure,
right?
And everywhere you look, it'll be a little bit different. I did a recent story from the Gulf Coast on the use of oyster shells and marsh grass plantings, and people are actually planting them in front of their yards and reducing erosion, actually reversing erosion, seeing land kind of coming back. But then, you know, in different ecosystems, in different areas, you have to approach it with different solutions. And what we are seeing here is the growth of mangroves in areas where they didn't used to grow. So scientists are investigating whether that could be a living shoreline solution in new areas.
And we saw quite a bit of mangrove growth yesterday out on the intercoastal. Mike Shirley, that's somewhat of a new phenomenon in this area.
Yes. And, you know, one of the exciting things about having this research reserve and where it's located is we sit right at a place in the coast, on the coast of Florida, between where you have almost all salt marsh grass and where you have almost all mangroves. And this has led to a variety of research projects to understand how that change from mangroves to sea, from marsh grass to mangroves affects the biology of the area. But it also has been serving as a great research and development site for living shorelines.
Now, Christine, on the line from Gainesville over at UF, let's talk about your study, which is happening at the reserve right now. You're looking at the threat of boat traffic to coastal ecosystems. Tell me a little bit about your work.
Sure, yeah. So I got interested in working on boats and living shorelines in 2014 and talking with Mike Shirley and other managers at the GTM NIR. And what they are observing is rapid erosion, up to a meter a year of salt marsh and oyster reef habitat that typically lines the lower intertidal areas of these wetlands, and that in a lot of locations, this rapid erosion is not being driven by the natural hydrodynamics of the system, but instead by boat traffic. So we designed an experiment and a study to develop a new type of living shorelines that's meant to withstand really high energy conditions. Some of the typical living shorelines approaches that are used in other locations just don't hold up when they're battered by wakes, boat wakes regularly. So we have partnered up with folks at the GTM NIR, a coastal engineer and a geotechnical engineer, as well as some Dutch ecologists to design a new living shorelines technique, and we're getting some exciting results.
What are the results?
So we are finding sediment accreting behind these new, what we're calling hybrid living shoreline structures. So we've been deploying what are called branch-filled breakwalls. This is an approach that's been used for centuries in the Netherlands to reclaim salt marsh in high-energy conditions along the Dutch Waddenzee. And so we took that same technique and transplanted it to Florida to see if we could use similar structures to dissipate boat wakes before they act on our shoreline edges. And what we're finding is that they're working quite well at dissipating boat wakes before they reach the shore. And we're finding sediment building up behind them and the progradation or the movement of the salt marsh back towards the intercoastal waterway, despite these areas being affected by oftentimes hundreds of boats a day.
Wow. And John Upton, as you've been writing about at Climate Central, Florida, according to the Army Corps data you've analyzed, is actually becoming a leader in this.
Florida is very much a leader. You know, Florida has a lot of vulnerabilities, a lot of coastline, a lot of flooding issues, a lot of erosion problems. And when we look at the data, we're seeing a large proportion of the living shorelines that are being put in nationwide are going into Florida. I looked at the latest Army Corps data this morning. About 10% of permits issued nationwide in the last few years for hard seawalls and so forth have been in Florida. But when you look at the living shorelines, Florida accounts for about half of all the federal permits issued in recent years.
And you've kind of likened this to if a neighbor sees another neighbor installing solar panels, they might be more likely to consider that. Living shorelines is a similar type of phenomenon, isn't it? People observe a neighbor doing it and they think, oh, that might work for me.
What you see is hotspots emerging, and there's a real big hotspot emerging around Choctahatchee Bay, but it happens elsewhere too. People tell their neighbors, they see what their neighbors are doing, they want to do what their neighbors are doing if they have a good idea. They love looking at the wildlife in these things. They see the erosion being reversed and they want one too. And a lot of the time it's actually very difficult for property owners to get these things installed because there's more demand than there is supply.
More demand than there is supply. So what can be done about that over time, do you think, Mike Shirley? As this becomes more commonplace.
Right. Well, one of the primary needs right now are more research like what Christine Angelini and her team is doing at the reserve, because it's, as John has mentioned, it's not a one-size-fits-all. And what we're finding when we do these really detailed studies of the sediment dynamics and the wave energies that are able to be done by this kind of a research is that you have to do adaptive management. You start off with a concept that may work, and then you notice, oh, the wave energy is not quite as we predicted, so you change things. And so we're really using the reserve as sort of a place to test out different technologies before it gets too widespread, because what we don't want are living shorelines failing in places where people count on them. So we want to basically learn how you would make a living shoreline under different wave energy conditions. And there's still quite a bit of work to be done.
Christine, so your research and those of colleagues like you, it's pretty important. And as Mike said, it'll adapt and evolve over time, it sounds like.
Yes, these are meant to be living, right? They're made of living organisms. And so that's the whole concept behind these living shorelines, is that they are dynamic through time. And what's is evident from discussions with many other managers and restoration practitioners across the state is that their successes and failures, and where these structures work. And I think we have a lot of work to do to better understand that. But I think there's also opportunities for basically improving the ecological functionality of some of our hardened shorelines as well. So I think there's two major areas of exciting research going forward, is looking at the context dependency of the functionality of living shorelines and trying to tailor techniques to different ecological and physical conditions that that characterize our dynamic coastal environment. And the other thing is to start to think about how do we take advantage of all the hard infrastructure that we have on the shoreline and improve its ecological functionality as well as its performance in dissipating storm surge. So how do we take our docks and our hardened shorelines and make them improve even better ecologically and in the context of coastal protection?
It's important to so many people in this state and so many property owners, along with government agencies, the U.S. Army Corps, NASA, NOAA, we've all interviewed officials from those agencies who are being very proactive about this, but I'm going to quote, John, from your piece in Climate Central about living shorelines, where you wrote, "Seas are rising faster as heat-trapping pollution is released from fossil fuels, farming, and forest losses, while governments worldwide are taking steps to slow warming and help communities adapt. Elected leaders in Florida and our federal government have been dismissive of the problem." And covering this here in Florida, it's so striking to me as you see the private sector and some government agencies, the ones I mentioned, really trying to get their arms around this, and research scientists as well, but no political will in this state to do anything substantive about this. And this is the most vulnerable state in America.
I report all over the country, and what I see is huge disconnects everywhere between concern about climate change at the local level and the concern for climate change at the federal and state levels. There's a lot of action. Mayors across the country are doing what they can to pressure their state or to implement new laws and regulations to reduce fossil fuel pollution and to take steps to adapt to the changes that are underway. But what we're seeing in this country and in others is that we just aren't seeing any kind of leadership emerging at the federal level, and it's frustrating for a lot of people who are experiencing these impacts.
Yeah, and you see the impacts, Mike, at the reserve. We just talked about the mangroves. Mm-hmm. More mangroves are moving north because as the climate warms, they start populating farther north and they start crowding out the salt marshes. So you're at a tipping point in the marsh now between those two, correct?
Correct. And one of the things from a scientific perspective to keep in mind is you really don't make a value judgment in terms of what's better, mangrove or salt marsh. It's a change. These habitats have changed in the past. They'll change in the future. What we're seeing is mangroves, which are not tolerant of cold weather, especially a cold snap over a few days, are moving further north and displacing salt marsh. Some studies indicate that maybe that's a more resilient habitat than a salt marsh. But that's the need of the research, is to understand what will change in the fisheries, what will change as habitat resiliency. We're fortunate to be part of a national program funded by NOAA. So we have reserves like Rookery Bay in Puerto Rico that have totally mangroves. And so we have scientists working together across the U.S., understanding how we monitor these systems and look at it from a nationwide perspective.
Right. And Christine, let's end with you. When do you plan to finish your research, and what are your final thoughts?
Sure. So we got an extension on our project that was supported by the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission to continue monitoring what's happening with our Living Shorelines project. So we have another 8 months of funding thanks to their partnership. And we think that basically studying these dynamic conditions over longer periods of time is essential for really understanding their functionality in the context of both sea level rise and increased storminess in this area. So we really need to understand the performance and the resiliency of these structures faced with those dimensions of climate change.
Well, we look forward to your results. And I encourage everyone, by the way, to go out and visit the GTM Research Reserve. It's south along A1A, south of Ponte Vedra, and it is absolutely stunning. Go to gtmnerr.org. And also read John Upton's work at Climate Central. Very important. And it's great to have you in town for this project and research, John. Thanks for all of you for being on the show. We really appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Mike Shirley, director of the GTM Reserve. John Upton, features journalist at Climate Central. And Christine Angelini, assistant professor in environmental engineering sciences at UF, all with us this morning. And in a moment, a local dad, Dante Palmer, has sparked a worldwide movement. It's called Squat for Change, and we'll explain next.
Comcast Business. providing a gig speed network that gets business done. Comcast Business, beyond fast. More at comcastbusiness.com.
ViStar Credit Union, now offering its members health savings accounts designed to help individuals save for future qualified medical expenses. ViStar, we never forget that it's your money. Information available at 777-6000 or vistarcu.org.
Gerd Berliner was 14 years old when his father and mother sent him out of Germany to escape the Nazis.
The pain that she felt must have been so terrible. But she let me go.
He took with him a toy monkey, which years later would lead to a great discovery. I'm Ari Shapiro, a story of family lost and found, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
In the Northern California campfire, dozens died trying to get out.
And they say that many of those people died in their cars trying to flee the flames.
A look at evacuation protocols and infrastructure as California's deadliest wildfire continues to burn. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
America is mourning Stan Lee, a Marvel Comics legend who created the X-Men, Black Panther, and a whole cast of superheroes. But Lee's legacy is as entangled as one of Spider-Man's webs. He taught us a lot about good and evil, and his message still matters. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Well, finally this hour, Jacksonville dad, Dante Palmer, recently sparked a worldwide social media movement. He didn't mean to, but it all began from the men's room of a local restaurant over at the St. John's Town Center. Now, Dante was trying to change his son's diaper in the bathroom, but because it was a men's room, it didn't have a changing table for babies. So Dante's older son snapped a picture of his dad squatting down on the floor, dangling the baby on his lap as a makeshift changing table. And in the photo, you see him trying to change the kid's diaper as he's squatting there. Dante posted the picture on Instagram with the hashtag #SquatForChange. So what happened next? Something pretty amazing. Dante Palmer joins us now with more. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you guys doing this morning?
Good. And what a great dad you are. And,
Thank you.
You've got three sons. And so there you are at the town center with your kids.
Yes, ma'am.
God, I've been there so many times. you're overwhelmed. The baby needs a diaper change. You go in the bathroom, no changing table because you're a guy.
Yes, ma'am. It was like a typical Saturday. My family and I got in a car and went to a restaurant that night. And it happens more than often. And I think a lot of times society, they deem it to be a woman's or a mother's job. And not in my household. So my wife was actually sitting at the table waiting for our food to come. And if you're a parent and your child starts crying, it's one of three indicators. They're tired, hungry, or they have a wet diaper.
That's right.
Right? So without me even thinking or even looking at my wife, I point to my 12-year-old son and say, come assist me with the diaper change. And this is what we do all the time. Went to the restroom and in fact, there was no changing table there. So I got into my perfect man squat and threw my one-year-old over my lap and began to change him. And my son, my 12-year-old, I didn't even realize he was taking a picture until we got back to the table. He showed my wife and I a picture. And it's what my wife said to me that kind of stood out to me. She said, you know, us mothers don't have to come up with creative or innovative ways of changing our kids' diapers.
Yeah.
And you fathers do. And a couple of days later, I posted a picture and here I am now with a viral picture.
Yeah, this photo went viral. And
yes,
you heard from dads and moms from countries all over the world
about this. So I got parents to reach out from Malaysia to South Africa, Austria, Australia, China, Japan, Denmark, Turkey. It's a long list. Even back to the states, from every city and state here in the states, United States, it's been overwhelming, but it's been a good platform to hear fathers and mothers come together, with, regardless of our backgrounds, regardless of our cultures, regardless of our religion. We can all agree on one thing, and that's being a parent, and that's amazing to me.
If you go on Twitter, or I guess any platform, but Twitter especially, and you search the hashtag Squat for Change, which Dante started, you will see tweets from all over the world, mainly from dads, but not just dads, saying, look, we want changing tables in the men's bathrooms just as much as our wives need them. And this is about not just the issue of how to diaper your baby, but it's really about the fact that dads are demanding society change and recognize you as equal in parenting duties to moms.
That's correct. So in my household, I've been married for 5 months now, and I prayed I got that month right because my wife would kill me. but in my household, we practice working everything as an equal partnership, whether it be changing our child's diaper or cooking and cleaning in the household. And we found it works for our relationship. And as we sit here thinking, even with this new platform, we just want society to kind of break those gender boxes and take us out of that. You know what I mean? Like I said, I lost my job a week and a half ago. So now I'm deemed to be that stay-at-home dad, and my wife is the one working. And if we put that out there, people were like, you know, he's lazy. He needs to go find a job, and the mom should be home cooking and cleaning. And that doesn't work for us. You know what I mean? So just having an equal partnership and understanding where we are as a person, or even with our work, or even as a parent, and it works, and we blend hand in hand.
Now, you've had some results already, haven't you?
Yes.
Some restaurants are hearing your cry.
Yes, a few have reached out. I think they have already had it, had a change of table in their restaurants, but now it's a platform for us to highlight them. Like Walmart, McDonald's, even Wingstop have had change of tables in their restrooms, but it's not something that you typically go in and look for. You know what I mean? So now that it's a platform and it's actually highlighted, now restaurants and even fathers and mothers are going around taking pictures of restaurants that have them, and we can highlight these establishments and give them praise for it.
Give them praise. You know, and as more establishments kind of transition to genderless restrooms too, just, you know, two restrooms and they're not designated man, woman necessarily.
Right.
Maybe that'll help change it too.
That could happen.
Because the changing
right.
table could be in an all-gender restroom,
right.
You know. So, but it's such a neat story, and kudos to you.
Thank you.
Because I know how hard it is when you are out there juggling kids and trying to get a diaper changed.
Right.
How difficult it can be, and parenting is hard enough. So, it's nice to see you raising your hand and talking about this, and I hope more dads. And it sounds like a lot of dads out there are speaking up too.
Yes.
Which is so encouraging. So Dante Palmer, you go, Dante Palmer.
I appreciate you.
And go to the hashtag Squat for Change. Read more about this. You'll see a lot of coverage. Jacksonville's own. And say hi to the family for us.
I definitely will. I appreciate you guys.
Thank you. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our director is Michelle Corum. Our theme composed by the Symphony's Pyotr Shevchik. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow.
Gotta keep an end in sight. Where there's silence and the moon, there will be hope and light again, and soon. Love comes in and fills up everywhere. Love comes in.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.